Hello and welcome to Overinvested, a podcast about pop culture obsessions. I'm Gavia Baker-Whitelaw and here is this week's co-host, Stefan Allen.
Hello.
So in this episode, we watch the Australian drama series Upright, a Patreon request from listener Thomas. Comedian and singer-songwriter Tim Minchin stars as Lucky, a down-on-his-luck musician who tries to drive across Australia, transporting the family piano to his dying mother. Along the way, he picks up teenage runaway Meg, played by Millie Alcock. So thank you so much to Thomas for sponsoring this episode on Patreon. Obviously, that is an option that is available to any and all listeners if you want to request an episode with me and Stefan or Claire. Also, there is a brand new Patreon-exclusive episode up with Morgan and me on the TV show Shogun, which is like the best show of the season. We're both completely obsessed. It fucking slaps. So go listen to that if you want on Patreon. But this is a very different kind of show. I'd actually never heard of this one before. How about you, Steph?
No, I hadn't either. Obviously, I'm extremely familiar with Tim Minchin, who is a very famous comic. He's from Australia, but he's huge in the UK.
Yeah, I was
as
like,
well.
When I was watching this, I was kind of wondering how well known he is in the US. I think not as well known as here.
He went to the US and, you know, has been doing things. He was involved in some Hollywood projects. We can get into this later. Basically, they mostly fell through. His profile was increasing, but a couple of major projects got cancelled. It's possible he's less well known.
Yeah, so like in the UK, where we're obviously both from, the cool parts of the UK. Tim Minchin he's kind of an equivalent to like Weird Al. He writes a lot of comedy songs, a lot of which are political and satirical, and is kind of a big famous cabaret act. And he also is the sort of person who's on tons of comedy panel shows, which are much bigger in the UK than they are in the US. And obviously he's Australian, so like he's a huge A-list celebrity in Australia. But the main thing that I think is like his mainstream biggest claim to fame is he wrote the music for the Matilda musical that was made into a Netflix movie last year. So like he writes stage musicals in addition to all the other shit he does.
Yeah, he's an incredibly busy and varied person. He is definitely comparable to Weird Al in terms of his status and stature, in that he is like the musical comedian of our age. But where he differs, I would say, is where Weird Al is all about the jokes, where every single line of a Weird Al song will be a punchline. Minchin is known for sort of, you know, even in a full show, some songs will simply be played straight and they won't have punchlines in them. They might be sort of interesting or witty or strange. So his music is much more similar to musical theatre music than traditional comedy songs. He is a pianist. He claims that, you know, proper pianists would sort of be sniffy about how he plays the piano, which is sort of a bit smoke and mirrors. But he is definitely a very accomplished and very impressive pianist to a layman. Even to me, like, I play piano. I can't play piano like Minchin can. Like, he is, you know...
I mean, he's
like,
doing like, it every like day. Looks... Actually, my other question was, have you ever met Tim Minchin?
I haven't met Tim Minchin, no. He is sort of before my time. He became so famous so quick. This is interesting, actually. So he struggled in Australia for years. There's a fascinating documentary about basically him deciding to do the Edinburgh Festival, you know, which is the world's biggest arts festival, but it's particularly known for comedy.
You can see Stefan Allen there every year.
You can. I'm on at 9:30 every night, if you're listening to this in 2024, in August. Anyway, so he comes through and basically he's a massive breakout hit. He is discovered, he is, you know, covered, he gets incredible reviews. Everything works. And a lot of this is about him choosing to look different as well. He starts straightening his hair, he starts wearing eyeliner. He basically dresses the part to look really striking.
This is also kind of in the Russell Brand era, to bring up a very cursed comparison.
Maybe
it was an era when that was sort of a thing. Like, what if I was like a grimy rocker dude, which like he isn't.
No, you know, he isn't,
to be clear.
Well, yeah, part of the joke of Minchin is I think his debut was called Rock and Roll Nerd, and the idea is that, you know, he's a nerd emulating the trappings of a rock star, except using a piano and musical theater traditions. So he became super famous super quickly. So it's quite rare to talk to comedians who really remember the time when he was kind of in the clubs. Although I have talked to the comedian Bethany Black, who's a brilliant Manchester-based comic, and she's the person who sort of got me into stand-up by explaining how you start, like how you find your first gigs. She told me that, you know, she used to headline gigs where Tim Minchin was on in the middle, and it's the hardest thing to do because you have this person who just brings down the house with these incredible songs. You just feel like the night's over already. And then if you get a comedian going on with, like, jokes about dating or whatever, like, it just feels like a step down. So Minchin was probably sort of, you know, destined for stardom in the UK system of comedy.
And also, there's such a deeply rooted cabaret culture here, not in the sense of, like, actually going to a cabaret, which is something that I did a great deal in my youth, but the kind of comic song cabaret tradition is sort of part of the mainstream, like in Panto and people like, you know, duos like Flanders and Swan from the mid-20th century, like you still hear those songs now. So yes. So people are kind of attuned to the idea of like a fun little comic song and like going to see it like stand up.
I think the thing that strikes me as well is just how hardworking Tim Minchin is. So, you know, he started making appearances on chat shows in this country. And when he did, he would write bespoke songs for the chat shows. So he has one song that is called 3 Minute Song. And the gag of it is that it lasts precisely 3 minutes. So when he gets on the shows, he gets them to start a timer. So you've got one eye on the timer and you can see that that is precisely how long it lasts. Again, it's sort of full of gags, but the joke is that most of his songs aren't appropriate for chat shows, since a lot of his songs are about atheism or they're about sex. They're quite sweary. A lot of them are very personal. And, you know, that has got him a very passionate fan base. But they're sort of confessional in the way a stand-up comic is confessional. So a lot of it is raising sort of banal everyday observations and raising them to the level of melodrama. So because you knew that, like, I think I first discovered Tim Minchin as a Radio 4 presence. I was 6 years away from starting to do comedy myself.
Yeah, honestly, I probably heard him on Radio 4, which is the UK's main talk radio station.
Yeah, and very well known. Radio 4 has a reputation for being very middle class, but also quite artsy. And he would turn up on that station doing his songs. But then he got hired to write one song a week for the weekly comedy show. I think it was Mark Watson's 7 Deadly Sins. Mark Watson being a sort of alternative comic who worked extensively with Alex Horn, who people might know from Taskmaster, which has become sort of a global success as well as being, you know, a sort of a very British panel show. So Minchin moves very quickly through. You can just see that he's just such a bookable person. If he is available for a project, you just know he's going to bring so much work and energy into a project.
Indeed. So our second star, we're going to talk about less. Not because she's underappreciated, but because she's 24 and was 20 when this was filmed. And there's less to say. But Millie Alcock, very talented. I'd not seen her in anything before. She's playing a teen in this and is a very convincing teen because she's very short and has a baby face, which is a blessing if you're a young actor who is having to play teens a lot. But she is obviously best known for playing Rhaenyra Targaryen in the House of the Dragon series, like Game of Thrones prequel, which I've not watched. I know many people love it. So I don't know if you watch House of the Dragon, Steph, and you can give any insight into it. No.
I don't, but I did look up an interview that she did with Matt Smith, who's also in that show, where they kind of take it in turns to pick questions from a bowl. And so from that, you get a bit of a sense of who she is in the industry. You know, she makes a couple of gags about Matt Smith being a bigger star. And that's what it feels like to me is, you know, this is someone, many, many Australian actors have done incredibly well on the global stage. But I still think there is a thing where if you start in Australia, you feel a little bit outside of Hollywood, even if you do start doing projects in the US. Yeah, she comes across very well. She is clearly very funny. Well, maybe we go into this a bit later anyway, but she is an extremely technical performer. You know, a real sort of do the homework, learn the lines inside out, you know, work out what you're going to do. She's been praised for having incredible instincts. She is amazing in this, in my opinion. Incredibly watchable, incredibly
indeed.
Funny.
So to round out the intro, the creator slash showrunner is a guy named Chris Taylor, who is known for Australian comedy TV, and he did like a satirical news show that's like parodying American news that's called CNNN. But I don't know anything about Australian satirical TV, so I think we can just move on from him. Well done on co-creating this show. The origin story is quite fun and kind of shows Tim Minchin's star power, because apparently like Chris Taylor conceived of Upright as like, what if we make a TV show about a guy trying to transport a piano across Australia, which is like, fine. And then got Tim Minchin to star in it. And then Tim Minchin wound up co-writing and directing several episodes and was like, I'd rather it was a drama than a comedy. It's now like a quite serious drama with dark themes, but obviously jokes. And less piano than I was expecting, actually. But like, there's this quote from this Forbes interview he did where he said, when I came on, I said that I wasn't interested in comedy particularly. It will be funny because we're all funny writers, but I wanted to write a drama and to act in a drama, which basically shows that he was showing up and being like, okay, well, I'm Tim Minchin. Not in a tyrannical way. He is, you know, making fun of himself a bit, but it's like he was very much a driving force behind this. And you can kind of tell that he was interested in telling a more emotional story. It's very much kind of in the framework of fucked up guy gets in touch with his feelings by having to take care of a kid, which is a beloved trope. And in this case, it's a road trip kind of situation that's really chaotic because he is clearly a fuck up. Like, we will discuss spoilers at the end of the episodes because I'm sure like maybe two of our hundreds of listeners have actually seen this show. But he is this fuck up kind of former indie musician, now sort of playing piano events kind of guy. And his mother is dying, so he is trying to drive the family piano to her on the other side of Australia, which is obviously very dangerous because the main part of Australia in the middle is just like a death trap of poisonous snakes and desert. And he, in episode one, crashes into a truck driven by Millie Alcock's character Meg, who is a teenage runaway who is just clearly like kind of messed up and irresponsible but really fun. And they end up kind of agreeing to drive together across Australia because they both are kind of going to somewhat close locations. And every episode is half an hour long, which is interesting because it's like structurally you'd expect it to be more of a comedy, but it's not really. And each episode involves like some total disaster happening to them.
Yeah, I think it's a bit of a slow burn, this series, which is weird to say about a series that's only 8 episodes long. But the first couple of episodes of it, it takes a while for it to show its hand in terms of what it does. In fact, the first episode is mostly static. They spend it at a hospital where Meg is waiting to be seen for, you know, the hand injury that she sustained in the accident. I think this really clicks at episode 4, and that's when you really understand what this is. And I would say what this is it's a road trip where everything that can possibly go wrong will go wrong. It reminds me a lot of Breaking Bad in that way, kind of only in that way. This is not like Breaking Bad, but in the sense of, like, it's two damaged people drawn together by a shared project. And a lot of episodes will end with a cliffhanger, and the cliffhanger is that something happens that seems so disastrous that surely that's the end of the show. And then we get into the next episode to go, okay, how do we come back from this? This is quite a chaotic, quite stressful, quite anxiety-inducing show in a lot of ways, while also being sort of very warm because of the two actors. It takes a while to discover the warmth between the two of them, but you know it's coming, and the actors have so much humanity here that, you know, it's very watchable from the start, and then from about halfway through, that's where I started to really trust it. I was like, okay, I see what the idea is now, and I just had a blast with the show from that point on.
Yeah, Millie Alcock is really good. They really tread this fine line of like a teenager who's just a nightmare, kind of like a little chaotic monster who's always making bad decisions and being irresponsible and really over emotional, but also like not morally bad at all. Like, you can see how someone would end up like that.
Yeah, a lot of the gags is that she is impulsive and unafraid of consequences, while Minchin, playing the character of Lucky is terrified of consequences. He is terrified of sort of not doing the right thing. You know, he is a very, very cautious person in a lot of ways, but he is forced to indulge in risky behavior by the fact that he has no money, he has no safety net, he doesn't seem to have a network of any kind.
a lot of the coverage I read of this was sort of like, it's very Australian. And I was like, well, at first I was thinking, I don't really know what that means because I don't watch Australian TV and I don't have a really solid grasp of Australian pop culture. And then after thinking for a while, I was like, actually, yeah, because there's so many kind of Australian movies I've watched that are, there's at least some part of it, if it's not like an urban story, it's very rooted in the geography because of like the awareness that a large part of your country could kill you. But also the idea of there's a particular type of personality and culture that springs up among people who are either like, I have to live here, or I'm going to go and do something that's really impractical, like drive across the desert with a piano. Which actually, when we first got our request from this from Thomas, I was like, interesting, I've heard a story about someone trying to transport a piano across Australia before. And I was thinking of the Burke and Wills expedition of 1860 and 61. Which, if you're a fan of a disastrous exploration, I mean, usually I'm in the polar explorer zone, as regular listeners will know, big polar exploration fan. But this is kind of the opposite, because it's when you go in somewhere that's really hot and inhospitable. And it's when a bunch of idiots tried to travel from, I think, either the south to the north or the north to the south of Australia down the middle for the first time, which is not something you should do. And it's like, well, first of all, like all sort of colonial expeditions of this type, it was made by a bunch of idiots who didn't know what to do. But also they brought a famously impractical volume of stuff to transport, which is similar to the way a lot of bad, specifically British polar explorers would take everything but not have warm gear. These guys were like, we're going to have china plates, we're going to have all this cutlery, we're going to have all these supplies. And they had a piano on this expedition traveling across the middle. And it was like, of course, it was a disaster. Almost all of them died in horrible ways. But this is not like that. However, it is, you know, very much rooted in the idea that, like, sure, you have the technology to drive, but you're getting into all these scrapes. Like, if you run out of petrol, it's going to be a disaster. You know, if you end up separated from your vehicle, you have to rely on the kindness of strangers or whatever chaotic thing's going to happen next. And I was kind of thinking, like, you can see where the roots of Mad Max come from, because obviously all of the Mad Max movies are very Australian in concept, but, like, the first one is obviously just directly set in Australia. And there's a lot of parts of this where you can see kind of the same source material. Like, there's an episode that has some sort of biker gang type people, and I love that. My favorite character was Esme, who appears in episode 6 and 7. She was fucking great. We can talk about her later, but she's like this just like hard ass terrible person who's in this like very tough community in this little town in Australia.
Yeah, there is a toughness and a robustness to pretty much every character we meet, and that's interesting. We meet a sort of elderly couple in a camper van at one point, and, you know, even they might be the more middle class characters we meet, but
they're a bit more sort of retiring and unnerved by the also, like a lot of stories of this type, there's this uncomfortable tension of how people are going to react to this middle-aged man traveling around with a teenage girl. Which leads to a kind of stress that I'm just like, it's too stressful, even though it's not in the forefront. It's just like, I'm thinking about it. I'm like, oh no, what if Tim Minchin's going to be like arrested for being a perv? Which they hang a lampshade on right at the beginning, because like, there's obviously no sense of that character being like that. He's just like this guy. But obviously he is potentially like illegally transporting this random strange teenager who's run away from home. And then they end up pretending to be father and daughter for most of it, which is kind of often the dynamic you get in stories like this, you know, that the Mandalorian or Wolverine or whatever. But like, they end up, at first it's like not very convincing that they're father and daughter, because like, they don't know each other and she's just making up shit to this like hospital they've had to go to for her injuries.
Yeah, they get the worst case scenario story for that out of the way pretty quickly. I guess episode 2 goes into that territory. But it is that tension of being, you know, these are two quite damaged people. And you're right, it's not at the forefront, but as soon as you cast an adult man and a baby-faced person playing a teenager, you know, just visually you are constantly worried and stressed on Meg's behalf, even though Meg is, you know, has her wits about her a lot more than Lucky does in the show. I think what's interesting about the story of the piano in particular, you know, when you first see it, you know, we're introduced to Lucky as he is driving along, he is on some kind of medication, he's got this car and trailer transporting this piano. We sort of assume, well, he's a musician, of course he's transporting a piano. But we learn fairly quickly that, no, this isn't how he goes about things. He doesn't travel with a piano to perform. He's taking it home. It takes a while for us to be told explicitly that his mother is ill, but it's extremely obvious. You know, he's got a video message from his mother that he watches repeatedly. You know, she's clearly lost her hair and she's asking him to come home. We know that he hasn't been home in a very long time, in years. And so the desire is to return the piano to its home, to, you know, this is Lucky's grandmother's piano. It's been in the family for 65 years. He feels it's right to take it home. So that's interesting that, you know, he could have jumped on a plane and seen his mother, you know, extremely easily. But to get the piano there requires driving across the desert. So it's going to take him, what, like 2 weeks longer or something like that?
Yeah. Before you even know anything about his backstory, which is sort of threaded through the series, it's such a recognizable example of sort of, yes, he thinks this is a really important thing to prioritize, but it's like bad emotional prioritization, because if your mother's dying, you should just fly across the country, even if you're somewhat estranged. But he's like, no, the important thing is there's this really vitally, emotionally crucial piano that I simply have to transport and like punish myself through the entire transportation process.
Yeah, and we definitely get the sense that this is someone who really hates himself, that in a way this is a penance, right? He feels that he has messed up with his family, and so redemption requires some grand gesture. Or not even a grand gesture, that it requires him to put himself through something incredibly difficult. Meanwhile, we get Meg, who, you know, it takes us a little while longer to get the full details. Well, in both their cases, it really takes until very near the end of the series to fully understand the full details of their messed up lives. But that's not to say that this is a story full of twists and turns. Almost all of the details of their personal lives are fairly guessable from the start. They're heavily foreshadowed. We get enough. They're not even clues. This isn't a mystery show. Just these are people who are keeping their pain to themselves. So the question isn't what happened to these people. The question is, when will they open up about those things so they can start to process and move past them? That makes it, I think, a very high-stakes show in a lot of ways because, you know, who are they going to open up to? Each other? Because they are terrible. They would make terrible confidants. You know, neither of them have their lives in order.
I mean, I find it very intriguing that there's a second season that takes place several years later.
Yes, yeah. I haven't seen the second season, of course. In fact, I only just finished watching the first one yesterday. But I will watch the second one. I'm really interested in what becomes of it. And I read an interview with Minshin where he says, you know, he is aware of the risks of doing a second season to a show that, you know, it was such a perfectly self-contained thing, you know, with a nice, neat bow. But I also think that is kind of in the DNA of the show. The show constantly writes itself into a corner and then has to work out what to do next. There are so many times in this show where, by rights, Meg and Lucky should part ways and should not see each other again. Or, you know, there are times where the piano, you know, it's sort of miraculous that the piano is found. So a lot of it is come up with an incredible, like an almost impossible problem to solve, and then find a way for the characters to solve it. So I can imagine a second season of this for the same reason that, you know, again, I'm coming back to the Breaking Bad comparison. Each season of Breaking Bad is quite different from the one before because it likes to kind of move. What's another show that does that? The Good Place. The Good Place is constantly reinventing itself and, you know, writes itself into a corner where it can't continue to be like it was and has to do something else. So I quite like that. I think that's something I really
admire.
Yeah, I
think from what it looks like,
modern
the second season is sort of they keep a similar format and they pair up again and have to go do something somewhere, which, no spoilers, but they've both got like radically different problems this time around. So their lives have changed completely, but they're still fucked up in different ways. I read an interview with Tim Minchin kind of promoting the second season, and I just found it quite funny from a Hollywood perspective, because he was just openly like, well, Millie Alcock, wonderful actress, obviously better in our show than in Game of Thrones, because he was like, oh yeah, I watched her in that show and she's very, very good in it, and it's, you know, a really well-rounded performance, but ours is so much more interesting. And I'm like, that's not what you're meant to say. And like cursing all the way through the interview. So it's like, he's clearly just like, fuck it, I don't care anymore. He also was like, obviously I'd never be in a show like that because I can't do a 7-year contract, I've got too many other projects, but if I could be in a Marvel movie for one role, I'd love to play some kind of fighty comedy villain for, you know, one Guardians of the Galaxy. And it's like, actually, I think that would probably be quite good. But also, if he was like that before, I can see why maybe there was like, he lost patience with Hollywood, but also maybe this is a kind of a symptom of having previously had a nightmare situation. Because I know you said that he lost out on a whole bunch of projects and then was just like, fuck it, let's move back to Australia.
Yeah. So let's talk about that a little bit. So he was working on he was directing a DreamWorks animated movie called Larrikins, I think, which featured Hugh Jackman, Jackie Weaver, and Margot Robbie. And I found a really long interview where he talks about this film, where he was really excited to be working on it. It was, making an animated movie just seems like such a different prospect to a normal movie. And, like, you know, really requires the team to kind of come together. And it was just, you know, a classic modern tax write-off where, as far as I can tell, you know, all traces of the show were wiped. And plenty of artists and industry professionals have talked about the pain of that happening, that something, you know, something that millions of dollars, you know, I mean, this is DreamWorks, probably tens of millions of dollars go into producing a thing and then it no longer exists, which is just, feels evil. It feels really wrong that that can happen to art, even if that art is, hey, a DreamWorks movie, right? Like, just the idea that you can create work and that, because of the tax system, you have to delete it so that you can't possibly sort of benefit from it financially in any way, is so wrong.
Hands down, the wildest example of that is the Coyote versus Acme movie, right? I mean, obviously, Batwoman is fucking ridiculous, but the... it's like, it's literally Looney Tunes, which is famously a very popular brand, very easy to market. Yeah. And everyone who saw it was like, yeah, it's really good. So, you know, but that's the evil Zaslav, you know, of Warner Brothers, who is the worst culprit of this phenomenon.
Yes, yeah. So in this case, it's Universal. Is it that Universal buys DreamWorks?
Oh, God, I can never keep track. But within a couple of years, there's going to be like 3 conglomerates and they're all going to be run by Darth Vader.
Yeah, so it's a really, really crushing thing. So he returns to Australia and he talks about there are 2 ways in which this project is the perfect thing for him after that experience. One of which is he is offered a show which is going to happen. It's just, this is going to get made. They're not going to delete this at some point. You know, there's never going to be a point where deleting this is more financially worthwhile and rewarding than not deleting it. So I also watched, what's it called, Foxtel Art, which is, I think, an Australian arts TV station. But it
owned
has
by
the
evil fox.
Oh, that makes sense. That's where the fox comes from. So it has 2 critics on it talking about the show. And it is really interesting hearing 2 Australian critics talk about this. And they talk about, you know, the subtlety of the directing and they talk very intelligently about it and very passionately. And you can just sense the pride of, like, we made this, like, our culture made this. And that's really exciting, that it's exciting to have a thing. Maybe this is me projecting a little bit, because whenever there is a really good Welsh thing, I'm just so, so delighted, especially when it's, like, of Wales, you know, that, like, every so often you'll get a film about Wales. You know, people love Pride, and, you know, I haven't seen Pride because of this, like, the dissonance of a film about Wales that isn't sort of a Wales first approach. But, like, I feel that feeling of going, oh yeah, this is just great, this is exciting, this is properly of its culture and it speaks to us. So there's that side of it, which is to be producing work to a high standard. But, you know, Warner Brothers isn't going to buy out a studio in Australia, probably. Actually, I don't want to curse. So working on something going, I know for a fact that I'm working on something proper that will exist, clearly re-energizes him. The other way in which this came at the perfect time is because Lucky is this messed up guy with a complicated relationship to his family. Minchin channels into that the guilt he feels about dragging his wife and children to America, ultimately to no avail, which isn't his fault, but, you know, I can see how you would feel, especially like returning to Australia going, you've just got some stuff to work through. So one of the things he says is that he really gets into the idea of what it means to be upright. So I think the implication there is that the name of the show existed already. So what does exist when he comes on board is an absurdist Waiting for Godot-style buddy comedy. And Minchin is the one who turns it into a drama specifically about redemption. There's one interview where he refers to the show as relentlessly multi-layered. This feels to me like, the musical theatre guy in him, where working in big metaphors that are really clearly communicated. You can't watch this show without understanding really clearly that the title has a double meaning, because it's a show that is working on many layers at all times, but not in a particularly subtle way. Not in an unsubtle way. It's not clumsy either. Like, I think the balance is right. But Minchin also talks about becoming addicted to this story. That, you know, throwing himself into this work is what pulls him out of his funk. Now, this is my interpretation. I do wonder whether finding a project that you can throw yourself into and go, this is my redemption arc. There's a parallel here, right? That for Minchin, it's making this TV show. For the character he plays, it's transporting this piano from one end of Australia to the
Unfortunately,
other.
Unfortunately, Tim Minchin can act. So
So he is very good in this. I snobbishly assumed, I know he has acted, you know, he has starred in musicals. He played Judas.
Yeah, but that's definitely a different famous thing.
Yeah. So what I was thinking was, we are going to get an incredibly charismatic and funny man doing his thing, and then Millie Alcock is going to bring the actual acting chops. And Minchin absolutely holds his own. He brings a different style of performance to Alcock's, I think, but one that is really, there is subtlety in it, and he plays such a great broken man. My favourite thing that he does throughout this show is when he is in the company of someone that he wants to kind of be polite to. So he'll do this thing of just looking like he is just dead. And then he looks up and smiles. And the smile is never, you know, it never entirely papers over the crack. Yeah. But also, it is a warm one. Like, it's really strange, right? It's, we like him when he does that smile. Because he is, because it's coming from a place of wanting the person he's with to... I do think he's a people pleaser in a lot of ways, this character. Like, a lot of comedians get into comedy as people pleasers, you know, the idea of getting on stage. You have to be quite agreeable as a comic.
And that's why they all go mad.
Absolutely. Yeah. And here's the thing I feel about this show is that Lucky is very hard on himself, but there are questions of, like, does he deserve to be treated as poorly, actually, by his family, or particularly by his brother? You know, he has this... We learn early that he had like a rift with his brother. They used to be in a band together, and then that fell apart. So we get more and more details about that. Yeah. But
I mean, I think they make it quite clear that, so what happened is, like, they were in a band together with all the kind of lifestyle that entailed, and then his brother went into just a dull corporate job and got married to this quite conventional woman and settled down. And this completely uprooted Lucky's life, because he could no longer be in a band with his brother that was quite successful and had sort of an indie following. And then he had to just go and be like a fuck up piano player somewhere and just be broke, while his brother was sort of like, I've cut my hair and I've got this sensible job and I've settled down. So they actually do make it clear that his brother is a dick, not because he's decided to settle down, which I think is quite normal for a lot of people who've had like an unstable arts job in their youth, but because he's just rubbing it in Lucky's face all the time and is constantly belittling Lucky and telling him that he's being irresponsible. And there's this really kind of embittered streak, and obviously Lucky and him have like reasons to have a conflict between each other, but even though Lucky is a fuck up, his brother is just getting away with his behavior because he's got the trappings of being a conventionally responsible adult with a wife.
Yeah, that's a great take. I like that. I completely agree that there is a power imbalance in the way they connect with each other.
Yeah. And there's like no sympathy at all for Lucky. Like, there's no sense of him, you know, I guess like not making allowances, but just being softer towards him. But also you can see why that would happen if your brothers who are constantly on the road together getting on each other's nerves.
Yeah, that's interesting to think of, actually. Yeah, I'm thinking now of, you know, how many feuds there have been over the years between sort of double acts or groups who work really closely together, that sometimes when that relationship ends, it can be as vicious as the worst romantic breakups can be.
Oh, Stefan, we could have a feud.
Oh, we could have a feud. Oh, that'd be great.
Can't think of two people better suited to having a feud. Never had a feud in my life, touch wood. Yeah, I mean, we should talk about spoilers in a minute, but just like in general, I think you loved this show. To me, my reaction was, I think it was really good, but it's not the kind of thing that's really to my tastes, because it's kind of in the it's kind of in the introspective indie dramedy zone, which isn't really my zone. It's kind of one of the genres that doesn't interest me as much. So I probably wouldn't have watched it if not for this listener request, but it kind of was, it was an interesting experience. I had a fun time with Tim Minchin. One thing I would say, my most normie reaction to this is I was like, not enough piano.
Yeah, that's
which
funny,
is also
isn't it?
It's also really funny in the context of Tim Minchin being cast, because they specifically talk about, oh well, you know, there was a very short list of people we could even possibly hire for this because we need a good actor who's, you know, going to be able to play a starring role and plays piano. And it's like, you don't need that at all, because Tim Minchin got this role, then reshaped it to be a role that doesn't require him to play the piano, because there are like a couple of piano scenes, one of which is really fun. There's a scene where he ends up playing piano with this like biker gang by the side of the road. Then they're great, because it's really fun to see a group of characters enjoy music together and to see a famous person playing their instrument of choice. But that's like 5 minutes of the entire 8-episode season of the show. And then the rest of it is just them transporting the piano. And we have all seen TV shows and movies where people mime playing a musical instrument. And it's not like he's playing Rachmaninoff. So to be honest, I think you could probably teach any actor to play those piano pieces or mime enough of it to be convincing. So it's like, well, you didn't actually need Tim Minchin at all, because he was like, let's do one where I'm just near the piano. it's piano adjacent. But yeah, let's talk about the ending, because basically there's two things. One thing that's revealed sort of partway through the show is that Millie Alcock's character is actually 13 years old and not 16, which adds a whole other element to this, which means that she's literally a child, which first of all, means that she's doing something way more dangerous and irresponsible because she can't legally drive. And secondly, means that Tim Minchin's character is a kidnapper.
Yes.
It's like, he's now legally a kidnapper. Very funny reveal. And also it was like kind of slightly foreshadowed, but you can't necessarily guess it. And the stuff that is more heavily foreshadowed through flashbacks is when they get to the end and he reaches his dying mother and his estranged brother and sister-in-law. We know by this point that he had a one-night stand with his sister-in-law, which kind of blew up the family relationships. And we find out in the finale that he actually got her pregnant. So his child is being raised as his niece by like his estranged brother and his wife. And he's never spoken to this girl at all. So he is actually transporting the piano for her. So the final episode is Millie's character being reunited with her dad, who sort of traveled across Australia to pick her up, and then Lucky reuniting with his family and getting to meet his daughter for the first time and give her this piano without revealing that she's his kid, because that would be a kind of fucked up situation. But you kind of see the biggest mistake he's had, and it draws a big line under the fact that he's had now had this paternal relationship with this other girl who's not his daughter for the past few episodes.
Yeah, so the reveal of the child, because we don't even know he has a niece. We simply do not see the kid until the final moments of episode 7 of 8. So I think this is a very sophisticated reveal, because every other reveal in this show is foreshadowed, mostly because Minchin and Alcock both do a good job of, when they talk to each other, you can tell when they're lying. So when she says she's 16 in episode 1, straight away we get the sense of like, is she? And that is consistently the case. So we find out in episode 4, I think, that Alcock's brother took his own life and he would have been 20 this week, and that, you know, her father turned to drink, and so she's just getting out of there. She tells Lucky, well, I'm going across Australia to Perth to see my mother. Well, she doesn't have a mother. You know, her mother vanished when she was very young. So that's just not true either. She really is just wandering with no place to go. All of these things we know. I think we know from the introduction of the sister-in-law. I think episode 2 or 3, we get a flashback and see her coming to a gig of the two brothers band. We know there.
Yeah, there's like a flirty vibe in their eye contact.
Yeah. So every twist is foreshadowed. And then the reveal of the child is like, whoa, there has just been nothing about that. Like, thematically, there has been, you know, you can see straight away the implication. Loads of scenes in this show take on a deeper, more layered meaning when we realize that actually the thing that really hurts him is that he doesn't have this connection to a child that is kind of his niece, kind of his daughter, but actually is just a kid that's not in his life. That bringing this piano back is an attempt to fix that. Yes, he's returning for his mother, but as much as anything, he's returning to the daughter. The video that he keeps watching repeatedly, we assumed was because he is obsessively re-watching a video of his dying mother, and that's not true. At the end of the video, she goes into a room where his niece slash daughter is playing the piano, and that is what he is obsessively rewatching. And it's great. I really, really like it. I like how complicated it is. I like how knotty and messy it is. That, you know, moving on from, you know, his betrayal of his brother, from this act of infidelity, that there's a sense in which that is impossible because a child was born. But also, and this is what I think I really took away from this show, is that actually you are never totally past redemption. You know, you have the hand you're dealt, and it's sort of not too late.
Yeah. Also, you kind of have to have 7 episodes of setup to get away with your protagonist being a deadbeat dad.
Yeah,
you gotta give the psychological background for like one of the worst crimes.
Yeah, that's it. And also seeing that from Lucky's point of view, he was doing the right thing because this child is going to be raised by his brother, who is much, much better suited to doing that job, which, you know, might financially be true, but I don't, you know, like,
he'll have a more stable and normal experience.
Yes. How we see Toby, you know, the way he talks to Lucky in front of his daughter, I think, you know, this is a very, very messy family. And so we get to the other kind of, here's a strand we haven't talked about at all. We haven't really talked about the spiritual, mystical sort of predetermination strand of this show. You know, once Lucky and Meg are traveling together, they have a conversation about fate, where Meg thinks, has a sense that things happen for a reason. And obviously later on, we realize that this is partly her trying to make sense of losing her brother and trying to kind of cling on to reason. And we see that actually this is a real internal conflict for her. You know, if she ever thinks that things don't happen for a reason, that's really, really dangerous for her. Like, she really is on a knife edge. There is a scene that is kind of ambiguous halfway through, where we see her sort of feeling compelled to spend time at the edge of a cliff looking out into the sea, and how much of that is a compulsion to kind of, you know, stare death in the face and you know, the temptation of throwing herself into that sea. That's the danger for Meg, is that she is trying to find meaning, whereas Lucky has already decided there is no meaning. And initially, I thought this was interesting because Minshin, in his stand-up, is very well known as an atheist and a rationalist, and a lot of his songs are playing on the idea that, of course, nothing has any meaning. Life is just a bunch of stuff that happens. That doesn't mean it isn't wonderful, but predetermination isn't a thing. So it's really interesting that this show really questions that. I would argue that this show does have a mystical component. When Meg and Lucky are separated, they are often miraculously reunited. When the piano is taken, the piano is often...
Yeah, it's like a wild coincidence-based drama.
Yeah. And they have a conversation in episode 1 about a member of the Electric Light Orchestra. I didn't know this story. I assume this is true, that one of them was killed by a hay bale that came loose in a field.
I just googled it. It is in fact true. Yellow was Mike Edwards killed by a bale of hay in freak crash 2010.
Oh, in 2010, so really, yeah, more recent than I'd assumed as well. So Minchin's character believes that it's just the law of large numbers. Enough hay bales in enough fields and enough musicians in enough cars driving past, eventually, you know, one in a million chances happen every day. And Meg, there's a line where Meg says, "I am your hay bale." You know, kind of the payoff of this is that in the end, Meg is absolutely the perfect person to be in Lucky's home when he returns to patch up. You know, she is the person who can look Lucky's brother in the eye and say, although she doesn't look him in the eye, actually, this is an incredible performance choice by Alcock, is to kind of almost sort of monologue this into the middle distance, is her processing her take on Lucky and to be like, this is just an incredibly sad man. She says he has an old soul, but not the way people normally use that phrase, that his soul is like a banged up, broken car that barely works. And, you know, that he's just really trying his best. And she lists, and this is interesting because I think we watch this show going, you know, he often makes incredibly selfish choices. He is often irresponsible with Meg. That sort of changes when he realizes how young she is. But even so, you know, this is not the most responsible and reliable sort of adult in the world. But under the surface, there are just consistent acts of incredible kindness and generosity where he gives up big chunks of time that he doesn't think he has to provide Meg with what she needs. For me, the turning point came slightly before this, but I think a really important moment in the show is where Meg is upset because she's hit and killed, or nearly killed, a llama, and wants to put it out of its misery and bury it and have a funeral and have a song played. And Lucky just patiently, you know, goes along with all of that. Even though he really wants to just get going, he finds the kindest way to, you know, help this llama go to sleep and you know, digs it a grave and plays a song. That's my favourite aspect of this show, I think, is this idea of that it's destiny via the law of large numbers. That Minchin is not a spiritual person, but he is someone who is fascinated by the seemingly miraculous things that can happen.
Yes, indeed. I don't think I have anything to add to that. I think we've covered the show, which was intriguing, and you can report back to me on season two.
Yes, I'm definitely going to watch season two.
You can let me know if there's more singing.
Imagine if it's just a full musical. And well, it's like Glee,
I did look up what the premise was, and I was like, is there going to be more songs in this? A full musical is probably what people would expect more of him, but I imagine he's like, can I get a break, please?
Here is something I can now reveal now that we're in the spoiler section. So I do know one thing about season two, which is that he wrote a song for his, you know, for his on-screen daughter to sing.
Oh, okay.
And there is an absolutely gorgeous video of a Tim Minchin concert where he brings on the now 12-year-old actress of the daughter to join him and sing the song. And she's a star, like she's a very good performer on telly, but she is not a live performer. So she has never sung to more than about 20 people. And now she's in front of this enormous audience. She's incredibly overwhelmed and nervous. But also, you know, she's capable of handling it. You know, she's clearly like a kid who has worked in showbiz for a long time. But it is very lovely seeing how Minchin talks to her and helps her sort of through the experience. Like, she makes a little mistake when she starts singing the song and he stops and kind of explains, oh, sorry, that's me. Like, I always play songs slightly differently every time. And it's incredibly lovely. But also, that kid is a great singer, and it's a really lovely song. So that's my recommendation. Even if you're not interested in the show, that is a lovely thing in its own right. The song is called Aeroplane.
Cool. All right. So as always, you can find the show notes to this on overinvestedpodcast.com. Our most recent episode with Claire was on the movie Love Lies Bleeding, starring Kristen Stewart and Katie O'Brien, and various other highlights from the 2024 Glasgow Film Festival. So we've got some kind of horror movie recommendations in there, and like a review of La Chimera, which is this amazing Italian drama starring Josh O'Connor. And next up, Claire and I are going to be doing another listener request, which is the movie Hannah, directed by Joe Wright. Ooh. Which I love. I love that movie.
That's great.
Saoirse Ronan in a espionage action thriller, and Cate Blanchett. Great movie. And also, of course, as I mentioned at the start, over on Patreon, a new episode with me and Morgan reviewing Shogun, which everyone should be watching because it's so good. So yeah, if you want to request something, patreon.com/overinvestedpodcast. Also, overinvestedpodcast@Tumblr. And you can find me on Tumblr at Hello Taylor and Gavia at Blue Sky. Stefan?
I am on Instagram at Stefan Allen, spelt as in the show notes. I am on Twitter at Stalin, Stalun. Yeah, I think those are the best places to find me at the moment.
All right, lovely. See you all in the next one. Bye-bye.